Folks, fellas, look who just walked in the door. That's Lonesome James King.
Well, thank you, David. Good to be here. Lonesome Owen Saunders is up there getting his fiddle. He'll be down here in just a little bit, but Right now, I'd like to do this song me and you was rehearsing the other week. We was fooling around. I'd like to get together and do it if you want to. Remember that? I keep my love with you.
Glad you said it.
Keep my love with you wherever you go. Please don't ever hurt me or turn my life into woe. Yesterday someone told me that a new love took my place, but all I have is a memory. I know time can't erase. Keep my love with you wherever you go. Please don't ever hurt me or turn my life into you left me. I thought our love was through, and now I found out, little darling, I can't live without you. Keep my love with you. Don't turn my life into woe.
Keep my love with you. Friends, I hope you enjoyed it. That's a pretty one, James. No wonder I could remember all them words. It's been a while since we sung it, but I enjoyed it and hope you did too. Hey, look who's slipping around here in the corner with his fiddle in hand. James, that's your fiddle player and our guest today, Owen Saunders.
Owen, you got a good fiddle tune picked out for us today. Boy, I sure would like to hear one.
Yes, sir, James. When I was a kid, I'd listen to Chubby Wise play the old longbow on that Florida blues. We'll give it a try.
Thank you.
mighty fine fiddling there, I'm telling you, Owen. You got a good vocal number picked out for us. I got a feeling you do.
Well, I don't know about how good, James, but it is sure enough a vocal number.
No matter how you look at it. What's it called?
It says someone took my place with you.
Yeah. All right.
Yes, sir.
Place with you. Now you tell me we are through. Someone broke my heart in two when they took my place with you. When it's too late to make amends, I'm sure you pay the price in the end. You'll be there alone and blue. Someone took my place with you. You'll find since you left me here behind. In days to come, I hope you'll find you wrecked your life as well as mine. When it's too late to even cry, and with each day that passes by, you'll be there lonely blue. How's that, Ray? 'Cause someone took my place for you. To say a very special howdy to Mr. Ray Davis over here in the engineer booth, and all David Davis and all the rest of Davis here with the Warrior River Boys, and old James King even over there, James. So glad to be out here. 'Cause someone took my place with you.
All right, yeah. Boy, all right. Boy, I tell you what, man, you right on it today, Owen.
Yeah. Yeah, Owen, that was a good one. Now, fellas, y'all settle back, Noah, and take just a break here a little bit, and I'll ask you to come back and play the theme with us. James wouldn't want to close out our portion here without doing a hymn for the folks, and let's do one of my favorites, if you don't mind. I know it's one you sing awful well, and we'll enjoy singing it with you, one entitled The Scarlet Purple Robe.
Let's do it.
It's a story so unkind, in the holy book we find, tells how Jesus stood alone one day. False accused and there condemned, yet they found no fault with him, the man who wore the scarlet purple robe. Purple robe my Savior wore, oh the shame for me he bore, as he stood alone, forsaken on that day. And they placed upon his head piercing thorns of bloodstained red, the man who wore the scarlet purple robe. In the common judgment hall, he was mocked and scorned by all, and tears of sorrow fell upon his cheek. Soldiers of the wicked men smote him with their evil hand, the man who wore the scarlet purple robe. Purple robe, my my Savior wore. Oh, the shame for me he bore as he stood alone, forsaken on that day. And they placed upon his head piercing thorns of blood-stained red, the man who wore the scarlet purple robe. Words of truth that day was plain, from the lips out it came. In this man I find no reason he should die. But the multitudes then cried, let him now be crucified, the man who wore the scarlet purple robe. Purple robe my Savior wore, oh the shame for me he bore, as he stood alone forsaken on that day. And they placed upon his head piercing thorns of blood-stained red, the man who wore the scarlet purple robe.
Thank you, James King. That was some beautiful singing.
Thank you there, David. You're welcome.
Folks, we've had a great show here today and a lot of guests. Our good buddy Scott Brannon. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, David.
Owen Saunders, Marty Hayes, all the Warrior River boys. It's been a pleasure being with you, and we hope to see you again real, real soon. Thank you, Ray Davis. Thank you, folks. See you later.
What have I been doing in the last week? Binge watching stuff like A Black Lady Sketch Show and Black Dynamite and a few other things. I did run across a very interesting clip from, I believe it was 2014, with Bell Hooks and Cornel West, and we're going to hear that in its entirety. You're going to hear about that and a little clip from Matter of Fact we'll hear this morning as well. So a lot of stuff, some music, of course, and me, Kevin Amos, here, 1-1 for Sunday here at WRCT Pittsburgh. Good morning.
Reach the eye.
So, if you're outside of our coverage area, remember, you can listen to WRCT online. Live streaming available at www.wrct.org. WRCT Pittsburgh. You have no excuse not to listen.
Fabulous to see you all here. Had such a crowd. Not surprising, but it's wonderful to see you all here. And good afternoon. I'm Tim Marshall. I'm the provost of the new school. And it is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to this very special event, a dialogue between two great minds, Bell Hooks and Cornel West. Dr. Hooks joins us this week. Yeah, that's worth another applause. As many of you will know, Dr. Hooks joins us this week as a scholar in residence. I think this is her second or third time here. And this conversation marks the midpoint of this week's events. Students come to the new school to understand, contribute to, and succeed in a rapidly changing society. We are proud to host this series of week-long residencies with Dr. Hooks to help foster the critical thinking necessary for this challenge. And I'm deeply honored now to introduce you to our distinguished guests, whom I'm sure you already know, but I'll introduce them nevertheless. Cornel West is a prominent and provocative democratic intellectual. That's what they say. He is professor of philosophy and Christian practice at the Union Theological Seminary and professor emeritus at Princeton University. Dr. West has also taught at Yale, Harvard, and the University of Paris. He has written 20 books and edited a further 13. Though best known for his classics, Race Matters and Democracy Matters, and his memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud, Dr. West's most recent book is the highly anticipated Black Prophetic Fire, which is due to be released this month in October and is already receiving critical acclaim. Any day now?
Yeah, just today was the first day, but today. I'd rather be here.
Excellent. So this is kind of a book launch as well, I guess. Bell Hooks is among the leading public intellectuals of her generation. Her writings cover a broad range of topics, including gender, race, teaching, and contemporary culture. This fall marks the 20th anniversary of the publication of Teaching to Transgress, Education as Practice of Freedom, Dr. Hooks' seminal book on educational practices. This week-long residency is an opportunity for the New School community to directly engage with Dr. Hooks and her commitment to education and learning as a place, to quote, where paradise can be created. So please join me in welcoming Bell Hooks and Cornel West. Over to you.
As the practice of freedom?
Is it on?
Yeah. Cornel and I have been having that conversation. Cornel says for 30 years?
30 years.
So we are excited to be here at the New School today. I really wanted to start with a bit of a focus on Cornel because he has embodied in the last few years so much the lone dissident thinker going against the grain. So I want him to tell us what does that feel like to not, you know, everybody used to say, oh, Cornel West, he's so brilliant. He's so deep. And then when Cornel started espousing viewpoints that people didn't care for, they'd be like, your man Cornel Bell, he's crazy. He's losing it. You need to talk to him. So I want Cornel to talk to us. Because, you know, Sweet Honey and the Rock say, when you work for freedom, you cannot rest. That's Cornel really has not rested. I was just on him about how many things he's even doing today. So I want him to talk about what sustains him, his spiritual practice, what sustains him. Come on over, my brother.
All right, my dear sister. Yeah, well, I just want to start by saying that it is a gargantuan blessing to stand next to my dear sister of now 30 years. It was exactly 30 years ago we arrived in New Haven as professors at Yale and decided then to be faithful unto death in terms of following our calling, not just career, but our vocation, not just our profession. And together to be able to work together and struggle together and write the book together. We were talking about dancing at the nightclub, Breaking Wood on the chocolate side of New Haven together. And the 30 years later, one, just to be standing
In
and of itself is a blessing, is a major achievement. And so when I think of what I've gone through in the last 3 years, I cannot separate it from what in my own black prophetic tradition we call precious memories
that connect us
to something bigger than us so that somehow we can preserve a commitment to integrity and honesty and decency and to do it in such a way that you're always part of a network or a community or a tradition of struggle. And Bell Hooks, for me, as you all know, not just in Breaking Bread, that's 1991, was it, something like that? Yeah, that's like 23 years ago. But Bell Hooks, for me, has always been one of those central figures and sisters and comrade that allow me to somehow feel as if I can still be a force for good. And not just intellectually, but also morally and also spiritually. And also politically. And the fact that it's so rare to have a towering public intellectual who puts love at the center of her theoretical and practical work. And that is my tradition. It's John Coltrane's Love Supreme. It's the caravan of love of the Isley Brothers. It's the love train, not just of the OJs, but the one Curtis Mayfield had in mind when he wrote People Get Ready. And that's crucial because we come from a people who've been so hated.
All right.
And been so despised and been so terrorized and traumatized and stigmatized. How do you find some kind of intellectual, spiritual, moral resources to sustain yourself in order to try both to tell the truth, expose the lies, but also to try to keep the love of truth and justice and neighbor? And of course, as a Christian, I try to love my enemies.
And how's that coming?
That's a wonderful question. Samuel Beckett says, try again, fail again, fail better. Try again, fail again, fail better.
So are you saying that spirituality sustains you? The work itself, is it sustaining or is it draining?
No, it is sustaining. It is sustaining because, again, you know, you try. For me, the real models are the jazz musicians and the blues women. And when you hear that B.B. King, I'm told, is sick, but he's almost 90 years old, he still does over 250 gigs a year. It's only 365 days in the year. So if I'll do 125, I'm running far behind the King of the Blues. And why? Because you find joy in what you do. So that's that is sustained. No, that's real. And we live in a culture, market-driven culture, commodified culture, that's a joyless quest for pleasure. So the pleasure is insatiable. You never get enough. And yet at the same time, it's so difficult to gain access to the joy. And that's why the precious memories are crucial, because the precious memories are sources not of pleasure, but of joy. It might have some pleasurable dimensions to it. We've had some pleasurable dimensions we won't get into right now. But we talking about joy right now, y'all. We talking about joy right now. So that the but that's what keeps you going.
And well, I think that when Cornell and I decided to have our conversation, we were at Yale together, both youngins in the Yale pantheon. It was itself a transgression because nobody had really seen an adult black man and black woman stand up and talk together, disagree together, but radiate love and light. And we were on it. There wasn't any topic that we didn't feel we could cover.
That's true.
And it was really a kind of glorious collegial moment, one that you don't often get in academe. And breaking bread was for us the culmination of that conversation. Cornell and I just recently did a two-hour follow-up that I hope to. I have opened an institute. Cornell came.
Yes,
the Bell Hooks Institute. Brother Joseph came. Unfortunately, when Cornell was there, we had some logistical problems, like a tree falling over the driveway. But
We worked it out. We worked it out.
We went on anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what we hope the institute will be will provide a space for contemplation, dreaming, critical thinking. And Cornell has been my partner in continually validating the value of critical thinking. I was telling him earlier that I was disappointed because when I told several black women academics, prominent academics, that I was going to open this Bell Hooks Institute, they were really hard on me, like, you don't know what you're doing. You don't have the skills. You need to go ahead and place your papers, you know, with a Vassar or a Smith. And I kept saying, well, I want my papers to be where my people can walk in the door. And they were like, you're dreaming if you think your people can walk in the door. But let me tell you this. If you were here Friday night, I talked about the fact that when Rutledge bought Teaching to Transgress, they said, you know, our sales force doesn't understand this word, transgress. They don't know how they're going to sell this book. Are you willing to come and talk to them? And, you know, naive, I was shocked. It was all white men. And when I went there, I had brought a letter from an older black woman. She said, normally, I send this $10 tithe to my church, but I'm sending it to you because your book changed my way of thinking. Then I had the letter from the prisoner that said, I made your name a household word around this prison. We argue, we disagree, and we read our bell hooks. And then I had a letter from a child, and I was saying to them, there's nothing to fear about the word transgress. It just means to push against the boundaries. And when I read those letters from just everyday people out in the world, not academic people, but people who were saying, this work matters to us.
Yes,
of you who were with me and Laverne Cox last night, we had that amazing introduction to have that young woman stand there and say that she'd been a meth-using addict, that she had been down, 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 and she read bell hooks, and it was one of the forces that lifted her up. I mean, who could not be overflowing with joy?
Absolutely.
Because I am doing what the divine calls me to do, as Cornell is doing what the divine calls him to do and has been these past few years. I told him, I said, well, you know, we'll save talking about Obama to the end, because we know when Cornell gets on Obama.
No.
But both Cornell and I have been obsessed with the notion of prophecy and the role of spiritual calling in your vocation. I was saying to someone today that people don't realize there's nothing I've written that I didn't take it to my spirit, Holy Spirit, to see, is this where I should go? Because, like, when I was first asked to write a children's book, and I was like, what? I don't like children that much. I'm an intellectual. I'm not even happy. But in the middle of the night, I got that calling. You know, I'm lying in the bed, it's midnight, and I'm hearing, girl pie hair smells clean and sweet. It's soft like cotton, flower petal, billowy soft, a halo, a crown, a covering for heads that are round. So I'm up in that night, sitting in my red chair here in New York City, no heat, it's cold, but I am following the direction of spirit.
Yes,
Spirit said,
yes,
Belle,
yes.
It's time for you to take this turn and help the children see things differently, feel things differently. Amen.
Oh, that's real. That's real. That's just so real. Let me ask you this question, though. How do you think the prophetic tradition in general, but the black prophetic tradition in particular, is doing in our neoliberal imperial regime?
Well, I think that, you know, I use that phrase, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. And what we know is that regime is choking our spiritual traditions to death.
Yes.
It's blinding us. And we are lost in the wilderness collectively. And so, I know that you and I, we are people of hope, but sometimes it's very hard.
Absolutely.
I mean, I have a black young black woman student who braids my hair. She comes over with her four-year-old. Four-year-old always has her white dolls. And she speaks her deep hatred of things black. I mean, growing up in the segregated South, in the apartheid there, I had never heard any black person speak their deep hatred of things black. But a four-year-old, she was like, well, the little girls at school told me I can't be Cinderella because Cinderella ain't black. And, you know, I tried to reason. I tried to bribe. I tried to cajole. But this little girl's internalized racism was deeply fixed 4 years old.
4 years old.
And yet people don't want to see that we have a serious problem that begins with our children. The education for critical consciousness we are not doing for children.
Absolutely.
And I think that one of the things we have to admit, Cornell, our relationship to the prophetic tradition started when we were children. I mean, I just recently wrote a thing for a communist journal, and I was writing about the fact that...
We got a revolutionary communist right there, Carl Dix. You understand? Love him, love him, love him, love him, love him.
Yeah.
Go right ahead, go right ahead.
You know, from the time I was 6 years old, I had to read Matthew 25.
Oh,
you know,
Lord, Matthew 25? The least of these.
Yes. Unless you do to the least
of these, you don't
do to me. Every day of my life, every Sunday, I read that for the children's offering. And I was like, how could I not grow up to be on the left? Because that whole passage in Matthew was about being on the left, on realizing that it's who you serve.
That's true.
That determines the quality of your
But most
being.
Most Christians in America manage to do that, though. Read it every Sunday and still don't understand what it means to be in solidarity with the rest of
Well, evangelical Christianity especially is one of the most corrupt ways of thinking.
Commodified, commercialized
exactly.
to the core.
And, I mean, I was telling somebody, I love those evangelical preachers on Sunday morning. I listen to them. It's all about prosperity what you can get. And you think, wow, you know, why are people eating that up? You know, black people, you look at Joel Osteen's audience. We may be in the academy saying, how can we get diversity? Joel Osteen doesn't have any problems getting diversity.
Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth?
All of the evangelicals that are pushing prosperity, the prayer of Jabez guy, I'm forgetting his name. But so the question for us becomes, Cornell, how can we in any way bring back a liberatory spirituality to communities that are so devastated? I have pastoral counseling every Tuesday. And the pastor was telling me that in the past months, a number of black ministers have committed suicide. And he was saying that they had committed suicide in part because they feel they can't live up to what we are told is the kind of standard one should have to be able to serve. And we were talking about how dangerous that is. Like if the ministers can't keep hope alive, in their congregations, if they can't live in integrity, because you know a lot of this stuff is sexual. It's a lot about what people are doing sexual while they're saying one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a despair, not just in the person who's violating their own beliefs and values, but in the congregations that they serve.
That's very real. You know, I was blessed to preach at a church in Newark just last year. And the pastor was telling me they had 54 funerals in 1 year. He only got 52 weeks in the year. And the vast number were precious brothers and sisters between 18 and 26. I mean, that's the killing fields of neoliberal
Hello?
Imperial America.
All right.
Ferguson is just a peak of the iceberg in that sense. And we haven't got to the soul murder, the spiritual death on the inside. With these decrepit school systems where rich kids get taught and poor kids get tested. So it's hard for their imaginations and their intelligence to be developed. No music, no arts whatsoever, and so on, you know.
When I was at Yale, we would have these debates about Cornell, and somebody would say, "Well, he's not a real preacher. I mean, he's not gone to seminary." And I always remember Flora Bridges. She said, "Well, all I know is I went to church the other night, and Cornell preached, and 20-some people joined the church." So she was like, the truth of whether or not he was called was there in the practice. So that when we talk about theory and practice, it's all about how we can move into that space where we practice is real, is deep.
But both of us have a ministry of teaching.
Oh, absolutely.
And a vocation of teaching in that sense. I think it's a real sign of divine wisdom that I've never been called to preach. I've got too much street inside of me. And I just recognize
that. I don't buy into that dichotomy, you know, because I don't serve a punishing God or a dominating God. The God I serve is totally about love. And what is love calling me to do? And sometimes, Cornel, you have to admit, the Spirit catches hold of you. And you be up doing something that you think, I didn't blend on that. I had this conference a week ago. Queer for a day, queer now and always. And different white men were speaking at the conference, and one of the white men was talking about how they couldn't get their voice heard. And I said, I felt Martin Luther King channel me right in that moment. And said, "Preach the word, Bill." And I went directly to John Crawford. And I said, "Here's a black man that had enough respect for the humanity of white men that he felt he could speak to them and say, this isn't real," and they would hear him. And they had no respect for him, his embodied life, but that they could get on a phone with a disembodied voice, and that voice could have so much power, no matter what it was saying. And I was like, here we have the quintessential difference between black maleness and white maleness. And yet, here were these affluent, privileged white men saying that they didn't have a voice. They didn't feel free to speak. And, you know, one of the lessons of our day was that part of what we have to do from places of privilege is listen. And we have to listen in those situations where, you know, when I thought about it, I thought, wow, who is John Crawford? Because I told Cornell, us old black people, that John Crawford couldn't have been 60 years old. Or 50 years old, because our sense that white people will kill us, that racist white people will destroy us, has been bred into us from the time we're born, so that the idea that we would trust, that we could walk anywhere with a play gun in this nation, wouldn't be there. So I really raised the question, Oman, how much did John's action have to do with being 28-year-old and being in that cognitive dissonance that so many of you in this room are in? That on one hand, you know white supremacy is real, you know patriarchy is real, but then you think you can strut out in your daily life and carry on like, well, it's not really real. It's not really going to hurt me. It's not really going to endanger me. And we know it's endangering us. Patriarchy is killing some woman somewhere, even as I speak. Some woman who felt like, that doesn't have a domestic violence, that has nothing to do with me. I'm in control. I can take care of myself. I mean, how many of us have thought that all the way to the doctor, you know, or all the way to the grave? I can take care of myself. That cognitive dissonance. I think this is a generational divide that is very interesting, because all of you young students in this room that are so smart and read and know so much, but then when it comes to the real everyday life experience, whether we're talking Oscar Grant, John Crawford, of how we live in the world, you can still have some faith and trust in the essential core humanity of white people, even when they're coming at you with guns and hate. It's pretty amazing. I always say black people are some of the most forgiving people on the planet. You know? But we'll be like, oh.
Now that's real. But the flip side of that, though,
okay,
is that, yeah, we're going to flip it. But the flip side of it is that Black people always are also some of the most scared people in the world.
All right.
See, that's what it is to be niggerized. See, when you are niggerized, you are told you're less beautiful, less intelligent, less moral, and you will have fear at the center of who you are because of the terror that will come at you.
I call it colonized, but
yes, but it's true. But as we know, there's some forms of colonization with those who are colonized and not niggerized.
Uh oh, he got to break that one down. I don't understand that one.
I mean, for example, Marcus Garvey, Bob Marley, British colonial experience in Jamaica, and the Maroons and so forth, they were less niggerized than black people in the United States.
All right, talk about it.
You see what I mean? Straighten their backs up and so forth. Now, that doesn't mean that Marley wasn't trying to learn from Curtis Mayfield. It was first Bob Marley and the Impressions, then the Wailers. Not the Whiners, the Wailers. That's a very important distinction. Very important distinction. But I say that because you and I, you know, we were blessed with one of the greatest gifts possible, which is undeserved love from older generation. All the challenges that love was felt, whereas we've got so many precious young brothers and sisters, not just black and brown and red and yellow. This cuts on the vanilla side of town, too. But to be, feel unloved, to have a vicious system that leaves you economically abandoned and socially neglected, to have your family weak, your community feeble, and then to have the culture of mass weapons of distraction coming at you every day with white supremacist stereotypes, like the little precious four-year-old you talked about, you see. Well, what is a young person to do?
All right.
You see, that's what you and I didn't have to worry about, because, you know, we get down and out. I mean, I always tell young folk when I speak in a lot of high schools, and I said, can you all imagine what your life would be like if the only music you could listen to was created after 2001? You see, saying no Aretha, no Donny Hathaway, no Luther Vandross, you know, no Sarah Vaughan, no Duke Ellington, no Mary Lou Williams, nothing. And we ain't got to Stephen Sondheim and Bernstein, just that little thin mechanized stuff. The drummer can't get the drummer song like Clyde Stubblefield or James Brown, because it's just a machine. Play faster. Oh, no, it's the machine. Hit the drummer song. Now I'm feeling it. It's the machine. Well, let me hit the button. No, I want the drummer. Kids can't play the instruments. Trying to hear somebody sing a song. One out of three of them singing out of tune, but they're still millionaires. And then for us, there's no dramatics, no stylistics, no main ingredients, no whispers, no temptations, no miracles, no enchantment, no blue magic. Y'all know who those groups are?
Yes.
What is distinctive about those groups?
Single.
And they listen. That's right. They listen. They got a faculty of receptivity. So Ron Banks hits it. DJ Reynolds hits it. David Russman hits it. Eddie Kendricks hits it. Otis Williams hits it. They're listening.
That's the only redeeming feature, I would say, of the James Brown movie.
Oh, you saw this? Yeah. That's true.
Because you saw that he was listening.
And collaborative all the way down. The Roots, I just had a wonderful dialogue with Questlove. The Roots is the last hip-hop band.
Uh-oh, tell us what you mean by that.
That is to say that. And it's not just the young people, it's these greedy oligarchs who control radio and recording and video all at the same time. So they got performance, radio, as well as presentation. And they do not allow for the Boys to Men or the Atlantic Stars or the Midnight Stars. They want one person they can control, make sure they control all of their products, including not just the records, but all the different shirts and so forth and so on, and the performances for money, and well, you turn them over fast.
That's why Dave Chappelle caused such a stir. And yes, I don't know if you've heard him say, you know, that here's Dave Chappelle with a whole audience of attractive young Benetton white people. And they're wanting to know, does he like white people? And he says that in his deeper inner core, race is not an issue. But he said, you know, when you are in an industry and you walk away from $50 million, you will see the curtain will drop, and you will see the real white people, and they are not you. Because what he was really saying was, you will see the capitalists, the imperialists, the capitalists. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that one of the things they were constantly trying to make Dave Chappelle do was put on a dress, be a prostitute. And one of the things he says was, why does a black male comedian always have to put on a dress? And when you think about the layers of that misogyny, that racialized sexism, the hatred of black women and using the black male body to be the instrumentality of diminishment of the black female body. And he was not willing to do that. And so when he began to show that awareness, that the critical consciousness, himself as a critical thinker, I mean, and this is something we're dealing with deep, he could not be in that world anymore. And I can tell you that this, that world will never receive him in the way that they did before.
Oh, that's true.
Because he showed that he was capable of holding on to his critical consciousness while making money. And we saw that when he said, when he realized that the white people were laughing at things that they were not meant to be laughing at. And he saw himself critically. So that when we talk about decolonization, we have to understand that critical reflection is crucial to the decolonizing of our minds. Even though years ago when I was telling Cornell, I met some man that wasn't very intellectual. Cornell was like, well, he don't need to be intellectual, Belle. You can talk to me. Black, and it's what. And this is what Cornell West said to me. And I'll ask him, has he changed this opinion? He told me at my kitchen table, black men do not want to be existentially self-reflective, Bell Hooks. Do you still believe that, Cornel?
No, I was lying. I was lying. I was lying. I was just trying to... Love can trump the truth sometimes.
What?
No, because I mean, I got my own brother. He's one of the most existentially reflective brothers of late modernity. And he is as deep as they
Cornell
come.
But Cornell gets the... Are we talking about the love thing? We're talking about the black man, black woman thing. Hey, you got me on that, right?
I'm talking about but the critical reflection. It's the critical reflection. There's a lot of brothers who are involved in critical... All I was saying to you was... Is that given your...
you know what we say in the black church? Fix it, Pastor!
Fix it, Pastor!
Fix it!
No, what I was saying to you was that I could see the direction of the flow of your heart. And I could tell that it looks as if there was some real possibilities here. And I didn't want you to trump it by somehow not giving this brother a chance simply because he had not read Paulo Freire. Now, you would find out, you know, because the fruit is going to come one way or the other, right? But you don't want to cut him off. Because, you know, I was with some sisters who wasn't that intellectual. And I had the time of my life.
See,
I mean, I married a couple of them, but it'll go right in.
You know, that was part of the wisdom he shared with me. Well, Belle, you know, part of why we friends.
I'm married to Elena.
Part of why we friends. If I want to have a deep intellectual conversation, I just come over to you and we can have a deep intellectual conversation. You know, that's not what I'm trying to do at home. And so.
Well, no, I it's not that I didn't want it, but you can't have everything. You can't have everything. I should have come ready for this kid.
So, okay, Cornell.
No, but we do want to tell the truth.
Then we want you to.
We do want to tell the truth.
We want you to throw down around the issues of black male misogyny, sexism.
Absolutely.
Have we progressed? I mean, this was a central agenda for us when we wrote Breaking Barrett, that we wanted to create that space of dialogue. We wanted to be exemplars ourselves. How are we doing?
I think that like you, I think in this particular moment of this empire and civilization, even given the upward mobility at the material financial level for the upper middle classes, spiritually, morally, existentially, it's a major setback, regress, and retreat. And I'll tell you what I mean. You look at the upper middle class, black upper middle class.
Okay.
A result of civil rights movement against white supremacist order. Jim Crow Sr. broke the back of it. Here comes Jim Crow Jr., new forms of segregation and so on. But you end up with a black upper middle class, which has been re-niggerized. And what I mean by that is you got position, power, prosperity, but they still scared. They
okay,
still intimidated.
I'll let you talk about Obama now.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about Obama. No, I'm not talking about Obama, because Obama's different. He's head of the empire. That's a whole different dynamic, you see. But then our working class, like the working class in America as a whole, massive transfer of wealth from them to 1%. See? So they're devastated. Then you got the land grab and the power grab in terms of the cities, the gentrification. Where are they going? Very few people keeping track. Then you got the very poor. Stop mass incarceration. Me and Brother Carl Dix this particular month, right? Mass incarceration, miseducation, genocidal effect. You see, I've taught in prison for 37 years. When we were working, teaching in prison then, I can see the difference between 1979 when I started teaching and my Rahway class in New Jersey at Rahway State Prison on Friday nights. Not just the exponential growth in population, but the spiritual condition is different. They have very little to fall back on. So their hearts are very hard and their conscience is very coarse, and they feel as if they're in the world all by themselves and it's just survival of the slickest. Which is a mirror of Wall Street. Thou shalt not get caught for criminality.
Okay.
And they commit crimes, they don't go to jail. They sip tea with the president at the White House, Jamie Dimon and all the others. You see.
So what does that mean for us as black men and women in the heteronormative space?
It means that we've got to just be true to our precious memories and commitment to integrity and recognize it looks as if at the moment we don't have a chance of a snowball in hell to win, but we proceed anyway because of the love that we have and because of the people who loved us. Which means you have to radically cut against that grain.
Well, I'm wanting him to give us some concrete ways that we radically cut against that grain.
Well, you got to form networks.
Okay.
You got to form, like your Sisters of the Yam.
Which I was with Cornell at Yale when I started my Black Women's
Group.
Oh, that
was rich. I mean, y'all let me in, too. I was one of the Sisters of the Yam. That was rich.
But
there was that space.
Everybody wanted me and Cornell to be a couple. Because it was like, the brilliant black man and the brilliant black woman. But he done already told us that was not what he was seeking. that was not the type of partnership. You have to read his book. What is it? The love book?
Which one is that?
The one now, where you tell your stories.
Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud.
Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Because Brother West.
Well, there's different ways of loving, though, Bella.
Brother West. Brother West was a player. So now that we know, over the years, he has raised his feminist consciousness, are you still...
Well, what evidence you got for that? No, I'm just kidding. You're absolutely right. And womanist consciousness, too.
Because I was going to say, now, when he was in my living room at the Bell Hooks Institute speaking, and I said something about his sexism, he was like, my sexism? You know? I feel that I have stayed on the forefront of feminist struggle. And so talk a little bit about Hillary, because I used to be on her tip.
Well, Hillary, yes. Hillary Clinton?
Yes.
Lord have mercy.
I mean, all may laugh, but for many of us, this has been a real crisis in terms of how we frame feminism, how we frame sisterhood, political solidarity. I confess, I transgress. I wanted Hillary over Obama because I saw some radical seeds in her that I didn't see in him where women were concerned. Well, exactly.
Yeah.
We know that clearly.
Well,
now.
They both are war criminals. Yeah. Both of them war criminals.
But
that's true. But Hillary has a longer history of neoliberal opportunism because she's older.
Ha, ha, ha.
But at the same time, as a symbol, now see, Obama as a symbol is very important.
He wasn't to me, but go ahead.
No. It's not just what he was in and of himself, but what he was in the eyes of the vast majority of precious black people.
Okay.
See, when they looked at him, they saw foremothers, forefathers struggling against Jim Crow, Jane Crow, terror, somebody now symbolically entering this White House built by black slaves. You see? Now, that is in a narrative, just like John Hope Franklin's From Slavery to Freedom, and it's a narrative that is powerful at a very thin symbolic level that cannot be denied. Then the question becomes, who is he? What is he about? What are his priorities? What kind of visions does he have? And it was clear, Wall Street, drones, mass surveillance, no focus on new Jim Crow and prison industrial complex.
Signing the Patriot Act.
Well, that's part of the surveillance. Well,
oh, yeah.
I mean, he re-inscribed it. But, of course, killing four Americans with no due process with the black attorney general signing on and so forth. Absolutely. But the thing, but Hillary is interesting to me in this sense, that because she not only had that longer history, but her husband is so exemplary.
Notice he kind of said that like Beyonce when she says, my husband.
But the difference is Beyonce didn't need Jay-Z to do what she needed to do. See, Hillary needed Bill. Hillary really didn't need Bill. That she rode his cocktail, his coattails. How does she become Senator of New York State? She just leapfrogged over the whole thing. You see? That's riding coattails. And that wasn't a Freudian slip, but just didn't come out right. Yes. But so that's part of the difference then. But you say for Obama, even Obama's blackness didn't in any way move you when he actually won?
Cornell, come on. Didn't we already know how this system is set up? I mean, didn't I coin that phrase, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchy?
That's true, but I'm talking about something irrational here.
Yeah, well, I ain't irrational.
Oh, I see. All right.
In fact, I remember one of the earliest lectures I gave, people asked me, did I think that his presidency would make a difference for black men? And I said, similarly to you, that I felt that the symbolic image was so powerful and so meaningful. And I told the story of the two little black boys employed in the White House where the one of them says to Obama, is your hair like mine?
Right.
And Obama can't hardly hear him, so he says, you know, he asks again, is your hair like mine? And Obama says, why don't you touch it and see? And the little boy is afraid initially, but he finally touches it. I see that as the kind of moment we've been talking about in these past few days about what we need to offer our children. You know, because Lorraine Hansberry loved to say that the only thing that should discredit us in the eyes of our children is that we haven't dealt with this color caste system. We haven't dealt with the aesthetics of white supremacy. But in that moment, he gave that little boy the affirmation. And you know, some little person had told that little black boy, he ain't like you, his hair ain't like yours. Repeatedly. So that moment was a really deep and profound moment. If we think about all the psychoanalysts who've written about object constancy, the mirroring, that was that I felt was what Obama offered to black people, that symbolic mirroring, that when Jackie Wilson said, your love has lifted me higher than I've ever been lifted before, for a lot of black people, that was the messianic, charismatic feel of Obama. But, you know, for others of us, we were looking at his track record, where he stood. And the man had pretty much fundamentally stood in middle ground spaces.
No, and that's true. That's true.
And so, I mean,
His language and rhetoric tended to move in populist and crypto-progressive directions. But it was just speech. He had Tim Geithner and Larry Summers standing right next to him, you see.
What about the black people who feel that people like you and I...
What help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, Go to irs.gov/identitytheft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identitytheft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
I want to know, do you love me anymore?
Thank you.